Talk to Me, a lecture series brought to you by WNYC.org. Going on right now is the Penn World Voices Festival. It's the annual New York City gathering for writers from across the world discussing and celebrating international literature. We're recording several of their talks for this podcast. So if you weren't able to get out of work, say, last Thursday at 1 p.m., here's what you missed. Jeffrey Sachs is the head of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, and he's written extensively about the economic challenges facing the world's poorest nations. In his talk, he'll touch on how the present interconnectedness of human society relates to swine flu, the financial crisis, and other terrifying themes from his recent book, Commonwealth.
I wrote Commonwealth a year ago to talk about the challenges of a world that was, as I called it, very crowded. I called it economics for a crowded planet, and one in which our crises are spreading rapidly throughout the world. And little did I know that in 1 year from the time that that was written, we would have a remarkable and unprecedented soaring of oil prices. Remember how they hit nearly $150 a barrel? Then world food prices tripled for the basic staple grains, which the whole world depends on to stay alive. And the number of people in extreme hunger rose by about 200 million, rough estimate. But I know from my own experience recently in many villages around Africa, we have a soaring and basically unrecognized global hunger emergency that we can barely fathom. Then it wasn't much longer after that that the unprecedented financial crisis exploded on us. There were glimmerings already of instability, imbalances, and so on, but virtually nobody foresaw the meltdown. In part, it was not exactly foreseeable because it depended on a number of cascading events and crises. The bankruptcy now, it seems, pretty much inevitable of the at least two out of the three U.S. Auto companies, the largest manufacturing firms in our country, on which hundreds of thousands and perhaps indirectly millions of jobs depend. And they just keep doing it to us. It feels a little bit like Job, because if that wasn't enough, well, we need an unprecedented influenza that seems to be a recombination of human and porcine and avian DNA into a kind of virus that we've never seen before, and so for which the world's population is unprepared. That doesn't mean that it's calamity. It may be turn out to be treatable. We've had outbreaks like SARS in recent years that after a massive alert and panic, in fact, came quickly under control. But it does tell us that something's not right in this world, that we're not exactly sailing from success to success. And it's my purpose, it was my purpose in Commonwealth, and it's my purpose right now with you to try to shed a little bit of light on these complex challenges, because I feel that they're not disconnected accidents. Certainly not a conspiracy. It's more that underneath our normal perceptions of life, we have become knit together globally in ways that we don't understand yet, and that we do not yet address institutionally, ethically, scientifically, in a way to understand and thereby to solve these problems. And unfortunately, while the United States remains the, well, fortunately, perhaps one could say it remains the world's largest economy, Unfortunately, our political system and our social ethic and our actual behavior in the world in recent years has not only failed to address the underlying realities, but in many ways has operated, in my view, in complete contradiction to basic underlying truths. And we're not yet out of the woods on that by any means. Even if we have elected, in my view, a wonderful president and a potentially great leader, our country is still very confused, very much divided, and very much still off course in our own part of this global puzzle. I called Commonwealth an Economics for a Crowded Planet to emphasize the fact that for our generation, really uniquely in human history, everything is interconnected with an intensity, a speed of transmission, a direct relationship of a nature that we've never seen before. World society has been interconnected from the beginning of humanity, and there's been long-distance trade for thousands of years, and there has been a global economy, at least for the last 400 years. So it's not that globalization is unique to our time, but the intensity of the channels of transmission are unique. When we have an outbreak of a flu in Mexico, and within a week, it's in dozens of countries, this is really something different. And in many of those cases, one can identify these were travelers, students from Queens, or other kinds of connections showing how internationalized these linkages are. When we have a financial crisis now, it's stunning that there is no part of the world that is left out of what happens a few blocks from here down in Wall Street. I recently was in villages in Malawi, in Mozambique, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, in Egypt, in Nigeria, and there isn't one that is untouched by the global developments, and that's within a few months. Why is that? Well, remittance income that would normally be coming back to these villages has dropped off because the migrant workers have lost their jobs or lost their incomes. In one community in Democratic Republic of Congo, which is extraordinarily difficult and unstable and impoverished region, of course, the whole mining area has closed down because of the global crisis. And so you stand face to face with villagers who have nothing to eat because they have no incomes. It's not as if there's social safety nets or other kinds of support or alternatives. And I asked, what are you going to do? And the answer was, what should we do? There was no answer, in other words. And this reached this community, this crisis, within a couple of months because it's part of the world economy, however remote it seems. Projects have stopped. The spike of world food prices reaches every food deficit region of the world. And I'm sure that we're going to hear soon that this virus has penetrated some impoverished region that has no healthcare capacity, no ability to quarantine, to treat, and all the rest. This is inevitable for our time. We always think it doesn't really matter for us, this stuff. You know, that's sad, but it doesn't really matter. At least that's how we act in this country, that this is not really our business. And then we end up facing massive instability. We're somehow surprised and shocked that Somalia suddenly comes on the radar screen with its pirates and all the rest. But what is Somalia right now? Somalia is a collapsed, hungry, drought-ridden environment without livelihoods, no way to support a population. The rains that used to come in small amounts don't come anymore because of climate change, which has warmed the Indian Ocean and led to increasing drought nearby. Populations continue to soar. There's hunger, loss of livelihoods, lack of livestock. Should we really be surprised that there's unrest? Should we really think, as we did last week, that the right response to this is $250 million of aid for a Coast Guard, which is what the aid was directed, not to a population that can't feed itself? So I believe that at the core of these challenges is a kind of perception of the world that says we're not really interconnected. We can stand on our own if we need to. We can build walls, shoot people, keep people away, but not have to address the underlying realities. What we're seeing, in my view, in the current mess that we're in, much worse than I thought a year ago, but the book was meant to be an alarm, and then the next year turned out to be a surprise of one more cascading crisis following another, is really the confluence of three kinds of interrelated problems right now, all linked as well to the misperception of our global connectedness. The first, and it's obvious and most apparent, is that the kind of market system that we have made and chosen in the last 30 years is highly unstable. And this hardly needs repeating right now, but it comes to a basic point. In our country, since 1981, when Ronald Reagan took the oath of office, and there were little bits of glimmers of it beforehand, we have been on an ideological course of what is proverbially called a free market economy. It is a misnomer to begin with, but it is the notion that we should take away regulation, take away the role of government, and let markets operate freely. And this came despite an accumulated knowledge of historical experience and worldwide experience that could have predicted many of the adverse consequences of that, but it was done nonetheless. It was also done in a bipartisan way in this country because it was as true in the Clinton era as it was in the two Bush administrations that bracketed the Clinton years, surprisingly enough. In all of those years, we gave free vent to Wall Street, turned over the keys of Washington to the leaders of Wall Street, said, send us your secretaries of Treasury, whether it's coming from Goldman Sachs, the other Sachs, by the way, not my side of the family, whether it's coming from Citigroup or others, we turned over the power to Wall Street. They promptly deregulated. They said, we want the rights to do commercial banking and investment banking together. We want to have an unregulated derivative system. We want to have ample and assured splurges of credit from the Federal Reserve System and all the rest. And what developed is now widely understood, away from the normal prudential system of regulation of a banking sector, we allowed what we now call the shadow banking sector to explode in volume and in force, and that's what fueled three bubbles in a row in the world, the East Asian financial crisis in the late 1990s, the dot-com bubble, and then finally this housing and other asset bubble that hit not only the United States, but the rest of the world, linked through the central role of the dollar, and this created this financial instability. Now, how did we let this happen? It was both politics and ideology in this country. The real politics were that power was given to Wall Street, and Wall Street used it to create a system in which it could pay itself tens of billions of dollars of bonuses every year and exercise profound irresponsibility, some criminality, some simply reckless gambling with our money in the interests of booking huge profits which they took home for their fifth homes and their sixth homes and their private planes and their yachts as if this is the real goal of an economy. And that was taken quite seriously. And Congress not only let it happen, Congress cheered it on because they did take a piece of their bonuses and pay the campaign contributions all along the way so that this became part of both parties' underlying core structure. But I think a second crisis hit this society and the world at the same time, and it's very closely related. Not only did we say we'll have a deregulated free market economy, but we also put back in the drawer concepts of basic fairness, equity, notions about human needs in an economy, so that things that one would talk about, like a fair income distribution, being able to meet basic needs, became a mocked part of our public discussion. I know that they're mocked. I spend my time talking about those things. And there was no real political traction here for our own poor or for the world's poor, much less for the last 25 years, as much as one could try. It's not that we are evil as a society or that people don't care, but we created a social environment and a political system and a leading ideological view, maybe in a caricaturish form in the Wall Street Journal pages, but really found much more pervasively in our society, that essentially said you're on your own, to get rich is glorious, and forget the poor, they're losers. And that became how we treated the most basic issues of human needs and human rights to health, to food, to an adequate living condition. In fact, we systematically dismantled the social safety net in this country for the poor over a 30-year period. Ronald Reagan won office mocking the poor. Remember how he talked about the welfare queens who were the real people that were cheating society. And that was a very popular idea. It led to the end of welfare as we know it, as was said during the Clinton period, which was really the end of help for poor people to a very large extent. We left 50 million people out of the healthcare system. And this was all treated as a normal way to proceed. We even lost the social discourse about wealth and poverty and about social responsibility. And to talk about that was to be called a populist, to be called a hater of the rich. So our country became very distinctive, actually, among all of the rich countries of the world. It's quite hard to understand how we went so far off course, because for 40 years we had a very different kind of society from the New Deal through the Kennedy and Johnson era, and then that fell apart, and we forgot even the most basic standards of decency, I would say, and understanding that a market economy has no guarantee at all that it will meet the needs of poor people. Markets are not geared to respond to needs of people without money. Markets respond quite well, thank you, to people with money. Under certain circumstances, they can help absorb poor people into a production system and maybe not only give them an income, but give them a path towards higher incomes. But markets are just as likely to trap people in poverty as they are to help people out of poverty. And a market system can be perfectly efficient and be leaving people hungry or even so poor that they die. In the U.S., we neglected our own poor for 30 years, but we have even more drastically neglected the world's poor. With the main question that we've asked about the world's poor that I've heard more times in my career than any other single question, why should we care? There actually are 100 reasons why we shouldn't leave people to die by the millions. And at least we should ask the question, what could we do about it? What would it cost? What could work? And so forth. But sometimes our society hasn't even reached that level of questioning in the last 30 years. We just abandoned the topic. And so this unfairness is the second crisis that we're feeling. We feel it in our own societies, and we feel it in the world, that the places where our army is fighting right now, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, the Air Force, when it bombs in Somalia, in Iraq, these are at the core hungry, poor places. And we have decided that we will approach these challenges through military means, and that that's the sound approach. And we have not understood a basic point, which is that poor people in very poor societies end up in conflict, in hunger, in violence, in mass population movements, as fulminant areas of disease transmission, as decidedly unfriendly, and why wouldn't they be? And we've not asked the question for 30 years, and we're still not quite asking it, even to this moment, what really can we do about it? We give money for military, but we still can't bring ourselves even to discuss what might be done in a peaceful and development approach to these problems. Till today, even with the new government that we have, we're not really yet even taking up this question. We've done about $4 trillion, perhaps, of actions of the bailouts of the banks, the financial sector, the Federal Reserve System, and so forth, but we've not spent yet one extra penny on the world's poor. That simply hasn't arisen yet as part of our internal discussion. There's a third crisis, which the flu is part of, actually, surprisingly, because we don't think about the flu and an influenza as being part of an environmental crisis, but it probably is. Of course, human beings have been afflicted by influenza epidemics throughout history, and so maybe it's a little bit unfair for me to classify this that manner as something special, as part of a broader environmental crisis. But the fact of the matter is we're facing more and more of these newly emerging infectious diseases right now. And I believe that they are public health and infectious disease experts believe that they are reflecting new global realities. A disease like this Mexican swine flu, as it's being called, at least for the moment, is an example of what's called a zoonotic disease. It's a disease that was in an animal population that has transferred, usually through the virus infecting a human in a mutated form, to a human-to-human transmission. Those zoonotic diseases have become frequent new visitations upon humanity. AIDS is the most dramatic of all, of course, in recent decades. The HIV virus is a zoonosis because it is a small mutation from a chimpanzee virus, the SIV virus. And as best as the scientists can identify it by comparing the genome of the SIV virus and the genome of the HIV virus, the HIV virus came into the human population around 1930, probably in the jungles of West Africa, probably by hunters of bushmeat or some other way that human and the chimpanzee populations were interacting. We've seen many such new viruses in recent years. SARS, of course, was another example a few years ago, which for a moment shut down China and Hong Kong, and then it was brought quickly under control, thank goodness, and what could have been a social and economic calamity was controlled. And the same may well happen with this virus, that it's quickly controlled, and we're certainly hoping so. But it won't be the last of this kind. And what we're seeing is two phenomena that are important. One is that this bulging human population, 7 billion people in the world, is encroaching on animal populations in new ways, whether it's through the industrial food processes or whether it's simply habitat of a spreading human population hitting new animal reservoirs. We're getting more transfers of disease from animal populations to human populations. And then as soon as that happens, boom, it's all over the world through airplane travel, through tourism, through this remarkable network now which links human society every day. And so we have a new kind of global public health reality and an ever-present challenge. One of the reasons that we're able to respond, even to the extent that we are right now, to this H1N1 virus, so-called, because of the particular types of DNA in this virus, is that the world was already on a technical alert for the H5N1, what was supposed to be the avian flu pandemic risk. And that network is allowing at least some response to this new influenza. But remember, there is no such response in Lubumbashi, or no such response in Mozambique, or no such response in Ghana, or the other places that I see all the time. There's hardly a clinic, much less a response. These are impoverished places that don't have safe water, that don't have a doctor or a nurse anywhere, maybe one doctor for every 100,000 people or 200,000 people. That's not going to work very well in the middle of an epidemic. And we have taken this as kind of a normal case. Now, this is just one element of what is actually a very dramatic and, I would say, unique feature of our time. The human-animal interaction is really a piece of the human physical Earth system interactions that's taken on a completely different character in our time. I'm heading an institute called the Earth Institute at Columbia University, filled with climate scientists, hydrologists, ecologists, public health specialists, infectious disease specialists. You really want to be depressed, come spend a day with me, because everybody's got a litany of woes about what we're really doing to the planet and what the planet could well do back to us in short order. So there's a term which I mentioned in Commonwealth that I have found to be a superbly useful organizing principle for my own thinking. It's a term that a great atmospheric chemist named Paul Crutzen, who won a Nobel Prize for discovering the ozone depletion effect, has coined. And that term is the Anthropocene. And the idea of the Anthropocene as a term is to say we're in a new era of the Earth, because we define the Earth eras as ending in the Latin scene, the Pleistocene, the Holocene, the Ice Age, the post-Ice Age period. But he says we're no longer in simply the Holocene, which is the term we use for the last 10,000 years since the end of the last ice age. We're in a new epoch on the Earth in which it's human activity, the Anthropos, which is the main driver of Earth change. And the point is that when you look at what 7 billion people with our 700 million automobiles and our power plants and our industrial economy and our crowding into new areas and our need to grow food have wrought on the planet, it's not only these zoonotic diseases, it's of course the climate change effect coming from our use of fossil fuels, from the deforestation, from the methane that comes out of growing rice or from the livestock, from the nitrous oxide that comes from our use of fertilizers and production at power plants, all the greenhouse gases. It's the nitrogen-laden waterways that we've created, because to feed 6.8 billion people, we are using massive amounts of nitrogen-based fertilizer. We have no other way to feed the world's population. If you like organic farming, that might be great if we had one-tenth the world's population, or it might be good for what you want to eat individually. But to feed the world, we need to put on a lot of nitrogen fertilizer. And in fact, now humanity puts on so much nitrogen fertilizer, it's even more than nature cycles through the natural processes of bringing atmospheric nitrogen to the ground for uptake by plants, which is a purely natural nitrogen cycle. So humanity is now a bigger nitrogen cycler than nature itself. And in the last couple of weeks, I've been on several discussions about water, the water crisis, just to add to the challenges. The water crisis comes from the fact that to grow food for 6.8 billion people, we need a tremendous amount of water. There are tens of thousands of dams on the rivers that have been put in place for water storage and for irrigation. We take water in rivers to such an extent that major rivers in the world no longer reach the sea anymore. Like the Ganges, it doesn't reach the sea anymore. The Yellow River doesn't reach the sea anymore. The Rio Grande doesn't reach the sea anymore. And this is happening all over the world. And a new study showed just a couple of days ago how major river flow in the world's river systems has declined substantially in recent years. We're causing the disappearance of glaciers because of the melting. Many parts of the world, including the American Midwest and the Indian plains along the Ganges or the North China plains, rely on tapping groundwater by putting down wells to pump up the water for irrigation. And the groundwater, so-called, is being depleted because we're using it much faster than the normal recharge rates that come from precipitation percolating back into the aquifers. Well, I could go on, and in the book I do go on to some extent, to emphasize that these are pervasive effects that add up to a massive change on the planet and a massive risk for the planet and a global scale risk as well. And they have another common characteristic with the first two challenges of instability and unfairness, and that is that there is no way in the world that a market economic system by itself could ever address those problems. And the reason is very simple. Right now in a market economy, it's free to put carbon dioxide up into the air. It's free to put methane up into the air. It's free to use fertilizer on your soil, even though it percolates into the groundwater and then is carried into the rivers and then creates a 200-mile dead zone at the mouth of the Gulf of Mexico. But it's free to use fertilizer. I mean, other than the cost of the fertilizer, you're allowed to do this under your private property rights. And so the point is that unless we recognize collectively that this is a challenge for humanity that a market system by itself won't address, we won't be able to solve that problem. I think in the end, I won't say in the end, in the middle where we are right now, these three huge problems of instability, mass unfairness and inequality, and unsustainability are our biggest challenges on the planet. But we are lacking two basic ideas, I think, that need to be brought to bear if we're going to have a chance to overcome them. The first, and I'm emphasizing it, is the idea that to address these challenges, we need something more than the free market system. We need a consciousness, a set of values, and a set of institutions that include government and communities and civil society and the marketplace, working where each part of society can do its distinctive part, but where we don't say, let the market solve it by itself, because the market can't solve any of these by itself. And where we don't say, oh, values, who cares? Poverty, who cares? Environment, that's for tree huggers. If we don't get beyond that, we don't stand a chance. And the second part of this that I'm emphasizing is not only moving across those social institutions with the problems in mind, but recognizing that these are global scale challenges. The United States cannot solve any of these on its own. And the United States cannot solve any of our national security challenges that we're engaged in right now, whether it's in Afghanistan or Iraq or Somalia, through military approaches. Because the problems at the core are about society, about poverty, about hunger, about growing environmental degradation, about growing population pressures, and they manifest themselves in instability. But if we treat symptoms rather than thinking hard about underlying solutions, we don't stand a chance. And if we think that this can be done our way because this is how we'd like it to be, we also don't stand a chance. And that's really where I feel we are right now, very much in the middle of the course. Can we find our way through this? And I think it's an open question, I have to say. I'm a little bit worried. I'll tell you the good news, then I'll tell you the worry, and then I will thank you. The good news is that on a technical level, the happy part of my work is to be connected to communities of knowledge that could also rattle off at the same time as they do all the problems, pages of creative solutions, practical things with powerful technologies that can be done to address extreme poverty, to help poor people grow more food, to use water more efficiently, to turn automobiles into 150 mile per gallon automobiles rather than 20 mile per gallon SUVs, and the list is very long. We have a tremendous repository of breakthrough knowledge that could be brought to bear right now. So we're living in by far the most exciting technological era in human history, incomparably exciting compared to any other time because of the accumulated knowledge that we can draw upon. But markets alone, the incentives of going out to make a buck, will never be sufficient to take that knowledge and put it into practice. It won't reach the poor. It won't protect the commons of the world, whether it's the air or the water or the atmosphere or the oceans, unless we decide we consciously need to mobilize this knowledge and this technology to enable it to reach all who need it. But the solutions either are present. In many cases, we could be saving millions of lives every year from already known diseases that have a 5-cent cure or an 80-cent cure and that would stabilize societies We could be helping countries for 1/1000th of what we're paying on the bailouts to grow enough food that they could feed themselves, because agronomic science is that advanced. So that's really the profoundly good news. The problems are solvable problems. They require the understanding that the problems will not solve themselves, that we need a collective approach to them, that we need to take social decisions, political decisions, to address these issues, and that we can't leave it to Wall Street, or we can't leave it to the markets on their own. The tougher part, I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, is that I'm not sure that we're going to get our act together in time for this, because the hardest part of all of this seems to me to be the spirit of cooperation and the recognition that we're in this together. And in one sense, it seems like an obvious truth. Here, the whole world is fighting a common pathogen. But what happens when the Tamiflu is in short supply? How collegial will we be? How readily is the United States saying, not only will we protect our own stockpiles, but let's start working with the rest of the world to make sure that they have their stockpiles as well? How likely are we to address the Somalia crisis, not only by helping to intercept pirates, but thinking about hungry people on land? When will we hear that in our political system? We've not heard it yet. And if we don't hear it, we're not going to get to where we need to go. The problem is that as the crisis becomes tougher, and I think it could well become tougher in one area or another, we may have a little economic recovery, and we may have worse climate disasters. We can think, and I don't want to think, about ways that new shocks will come upon us, but I think we better count on it right now. We might decide to hunker down, that this really is a struggle of protect ourselves versus someone else, rather than understanding that this is the common challenge that we all face. And if we fall one more time into that trap, as we did in a full way during the Bush administration, and we're that close to it still, if we fall back into that mindset, we will lose the chance, because we're so close to these crises getting out of hand that it's going to require real vision and steadfastness and major investments in the years ahead to pull us back from the brink. I like President Obama so much, I can tell you, because I think he really has a huge sensitivity to this truth, but I don't think that our political system does at this point. And so I'm not sure how far we're going to get. And I do, in my own mind, liken him. I think he's most like John Kennedy of our recent presidents. And Kennedy was, in my view, the greatest president in being able to envision what global cooperation might mean. After some pretty bad missteps at the beginning, some legacy from the Eisenhower years, some bad missteps on Kennedy's own part, a near end of the world at the Cuban Missile Crisis, President Kennedy had a year that was a miraculous year before his death of reaching the first treaty with the Soviet Union, the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. And what I find so remarkable about that, and why I find it resonant for our time, it was an act of profound imagination. It wasn't simply statecraft. It wasn't simply obvious. It wasn't simply negotiating something that was a necessary thing to do. It was an act of unbelievable vision, because you might have thought at that time, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, I will never deal with these people again. And Kennedy's reaction was exactly the opposite. He said, we came so close, we have to understand that in common humanity, we have to do everything we can to find the common interest. And he gave a speech, which is my favorite speech of an American president. Maybe President Obama will sometime give one that I will find even more of a favorite. But for the moment, President Kennedy's speech on peace in 1963 in June at American University was a speech talking about the vision of creating a world of cooperation. And it was given to try to help Americans see that we could make peace with Soviet Union at the time. And indeed, General Secretary of the Communist Party, Nikita Khrushchev, liked the speech so much that 6 weeks later, this partial nuclear test ban treaty was signed. And the words of President Kennedy played a huge role. And I often think back to that speech, but also to some specific words that I want to end with, because I think that they are the most important words for our time. They're as true today as they were in June 10, 1963. And President Kennedy said, so let us not be blind to our differences, but let us also direct attention to our common interests and to the means by which those differences can be resolved. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air, we all cherish our children's future, and we are all mortal. Thank you very much. If there are questions or comments, I think we have a couple of minutes, and I'd be happy to hear from anybody. Please just come up to the mic, and if you like, just I'd ask you to introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Brett Barnt. You spoke a lot about the challenges and a little bit about what our politics are like. Are there any kind of attractor factors or Lorenz's butterflies that you could point out that could, you know, really a few small changes could really then begin to redirect energy in a lot of ways? I'm thinking of campaign finance reform, Buckley versus Valeo. You may mention other Supreme Court rulings on property rights. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a good question of whether there's something that could dynamically unleash change and whether we're at some kind of tipping point, if you will, that could mean a mass social movement in the direction of sustainable development. I have to tell you, I don't quite feel it's there right now. I feel more that we're going to have to work very hard on continuing to change politics and press for a different kind of understanding of our society, because I don't feel that it's all just ready to be triggered. Even in this financial crisis, I'm not sure we're drawing real lessons yet from this. More we're hoping the stock market will recover and we'll just get back to doing what we were doing before, if we could just get the spending going and so on, rather than the deeper reforms. And so this is what I'm worried about, that we're not yet reaching some of the core. Now, I think President Obama is moving in some important directions. Of course, he's very committed to a new energy system in this country, to climate change, to healthcare reform. I think all of that is important. He's proposing to do it with a basically unchanged tax system, which I think is impossible, but it's a part of American politics that we don't want to pay for anything. So we want those things, but we don't want to pay for any of them.
But the we you're referring to is a small group of people. I mean, we are not hoping for the banks to rebuild
right.
themselves.
Yes.
A few people are. How can we defang those people? That's what
Good.
I'm asking you to talk about.
Yeah, thank you. So I think that that's a very good and pertinent question. You know, part of it is a kind of conventional answer, which is our voices in our politics. I hate to go back through Washington again for this, but Washington really is broken still. And I think our voices are extremely important to help unbreak it. And we're not there yet at all. And that's true in the Democratic Party as well as the Republican Party, by the way. So it is not a partisan remark. The other question, of course, is what can society do that doesn't have to find its way through Washington? What can we do in self-help or self-action and so forth? I actually would like a public social campaign for responsibility on Wall Street, for example, which has shown not the slightest awareness of the predicament that it's gotten us into, as opposed to taking the money and wanting all the protections and getting back to its mega-billion-dollar bonuses. And I'm just trying to warm up to find the right way to do it, to insist that bonuses that do get paid, because there will be bonuses, that at least half of them get donated to the world's poor, because Wall Street has shown no social responsibility in recent years at all. And this is something that public pressure could make a big difference on. This is our city. That's a lot of money down the block. Goldman Sachs is getting ready to spend billions of dollars, literally, on its mega bonuses again, and it's shown, to my understanding, no responsibility yet, no recognition of its role or its social responsibility. So I think that there are things that can be done. I focus on that, by the way. It may seem strange, but it agonizes me that when Merrill Lynch paid $4 billion in bonuses in December after they had gone broke. That $4 billion is roughly what the U.S. gives in development aid for Africa. And that was just given like that and forgotten like that. And it's a disgrace for our society. And so people ask, could we really afford this and that? Well, if we can afford $4 billion to bankrupt companies for bonuses, then surely we can afford $4 billion to help people that need treatment for malaria or bed nets or fertilizer to grow the food that they need. And this, I think, is going to have to be partly our public voice and our public response. But I wish I could tell you, I think about it all the time, that there was some self-regulating way that this is going to happen on its own, and I'm afraid that I don't think we're close to that yet, because we're still so far from the kind of politics in this country that can produce that, that there's a lot of change that is going to have to be built up before it becomes self-sustaining.
Hi, I'm Ellen, and I have a few questions.
Maybe just
you
one.
Can choose how you wish to answer them.
Maybe just one question.
One is, why is Ronald Reagan considered such a great and transformative president? And another is, what is it that you think we can do as individuals, and why isn't there a much greater public campaign about going on, given all these great technologies that exist?
Yeah. Ronald Reagan was a wonderful storyteller, maybe the best in modern history, and people like to hear his stories and believe those stories. He liked to believe them, too, but I think that he did a tremendous amount of damage, not only personally, but the movement that he represented did a tremendous amount of damage in this country. And it's going to still take us a long time to dig out of that. And we're only beginning to get the glimmers of recognition of how much damage was done. So I can't really account for it more than that. But we lost course in this country. There is a lot of, you know, good sociological reasons why that might have been. But the fact of the matter is we lost course, and he led the way on that. And in terms of individual efforts, again, more and more people are getting involved as individuals in their churches or synagogues or businesses to try to find some way to make a contribution themselves to real change. And I believe that it can, step by step, add up to massive change in the world. I have been working with an NGO, helped to found and work with an NGO called Millennium Promise, as just an example, which is working now throughout Africa on real on-the-ground delivery with communities of a strategy to fight hunger, disease, and extreme poverty. And it works, because these communities, when they're empowered with a little bit of help, they have a tremendous energy, of course, on their own and desire to get out of the trap that they're in. And with the partnership and good technologies, whether it's to fight the diseases or better seeds to grow more food, the kind of technologies I was talking about, there are tremendous steps that can be made. Making this into a broader social movement in this country is important. It's been hard to do. In the noise, in the din, in the multiple crises. But I think that that is something that's going to be needed over time. Maybe one more.
Okay. Thank you for the interesting presentation. I have a question to ask related to the environment. How do you feel about the use of the so-called depleted uranium bombs? Thousands of tons have been dropped in Yugoslavia. Thousands of tons have been dropped in Iraq. I don't know whether they're being used also in Afghanistan, contaminating the earth for generations to come, increasing the cancer rate in phenomenal numbers. How do we live with ourselves using them?
I'm against it. By the way, I'm against it even when it isn't depleted uranium weapons. I think all the bombing that we've done over the past generation has been a disaster. We've killed hundreds of thousands of innocent people. We have a way in our newspapers, even in the New York Times, to say that when someone dies under one of our bombs, that those were insurgents below. When the eyewitnesses come and say those were families of young children, people on a picnic, people on a wedding. We're doing this repeatedly, day after day, week after week. This bombing is our way of doing it. We don't want to have all the troops there. We shouldn't either have the troops or the bombs, as far as I can see, because we're not reaching any solutions. And so,
it's contamination of the earth for generations to come.
I understand. There's an added component to it, but I'm talking about the basic motivations here. We're trying to solve problems through military approaches that cannot be solved through
military
approaches.
It's the war machine.
Thank you very much.
Talk to Me is a lecture series brought to you by WNYC.org. I'm your podcast presenter, Andrea Salenzi, and I work with Otis Hart to bring you this series. We have more lectures on the way from the Penn Festival, so stay tuned. In the meantime, you should minimize your Gmail, forget your queue on Hulu.com, and head on over to WNYC.org. Let us know what you'll be attending at the Penn Festival. Join us on our website, WNYC.org.